young. She has not only wonderful documentary films, but feature films too, and she really is a great talent in our midst. She's by training a sociologist, but went into filmmaking, as I say, when she was still very young. This particular lecture that she's giving tonight is called Beauty in Truth, Shaping History. And it's a work in progress because, in fact, the film has not yet gone out, and she's going to use it to colour her address to you and to talk about the making of film and the role of film in narrative and telling us about our own history. This film is based on the life of Alice Walker and based on interviews with Alice Walker, who is a very old friend of Petiba and of course one of the seminal voices for Black America and a great internationalist herself. So I'm going to hand you over to this powerhouse of a woman and let her talk to you about beauty and truth.
Literally in the last few laps to the finish line, it was very hard to say no to the charming and persuasive Baroness. And also I am much more used to speaking at film festivals and amongst other filmmakers, so to come here and speak at Mansfield College, was I decided I was going to see it as a bit of an adventure. So thank you for being part of this adventure. Writer Alice Walker once said, "People are known by the records they keep. If it isn't in the records, it will be said it didn't happen." That is what history is, a keeping of records. One of my passions as a filmmaker is to ensure that women's stories as shapers and makers of history are not confined to the usual amnesia of male-biased recording of histories. And as part of my personal project to create and keep cinematic records of unique and inspiring women's stories that can teach us all about how to live in this world, 4 years ago I embarked on making this definitive feature-length documentary film on the writer Alice Walker. And part of it was triggered by the fact that one Christmas, I spent one Christmas in Northern California and was watching a stack of DVDs from a series called American Masters. It's an Emmy award-winning series on PBS, watched by millions of people. And all these DVDs were about, they were, you know, on Frank Gehry, the architect, on Bob Dylan. So these amazing men who have impacted on American culture. And of course, my kind of default position is always to say, well, where are the women in this? Why aren't there any of these DVDs about women and their stories and their impact on American culture? And so it sort of became obvious to me anyway that to ask the question, why wasn't there a film on Alice Walker, who is an American icon and is an American master? I partly thought of Alice Walker because I'd already known her, and I'd made a film with her in the mid-90s for Channel 4 television and for international distribution. After she'd written a book, a novel called Possessing the Secret of Joy in the mid-90s, the story was about, it was a harrowing story about an African-American woman who chooses to undergo genital mutilation. And so the novel raised lots of questions around identity and nation and belonging and the kind of psychological effects of this on the story was about the psychological effects of this on the woman. And as a result of writing the novel, Alice Walker approached me and said she wanted to make a documentary about this subject. And we saw it as very much as a human rights issue. So we went out and we went to Africa and we worked with women campaigners. We spoke to a whole diverse range of women who were for the practice, women who had undergone it, and we made a documentary. And in making something like that, it was, I think it was an experience that really bonded us, and I also got to know Alice Walker and who she was and is. So, you know, it was sort of a natural progression for me to then think about making a film about her life and about her art and her and the impact of that on American culture. Lillian Miller, who's a blues singer from the 1920s, sang an ode to African-American women in which one of the recurring lyrics was, "Oh, you just can't keep a real good woman down. You can't keep a real good woman down. If you throw me down here, Papa, I rise up in some other town." For me, this lyric captures the essence of Alice Walker's dramatic life. Indeed, Walker is the quintessential good woman who has risen time and time again to change American culture and its perception of African-American women. As a key American artist of the late 20th and early 21st centuries, her writings have given visionary leadership to cultural debates on black women's art, politics, and sexuality. She made history as the first African-American woman to win a Pulitzer Prize for fiction for her novel, The Color Purple, in 1983. It is one of the few literary books to capture the popular imagination and leave a permanent imprint on American culture. Walker is the first contemporary writer to write about Southern black women and their lives from inside the community. Walker put Southern black women's experiences and voices on the American literary map. As academic Mary Helen Washington says, though Walker does not neglect to deal with the external realities of poverty, exploitation, and discrimination, her stories, novels, and poems most often focus on the intimate reaches of the inner lives of her characters. The landscape of her stories is the spiritual realm where the soul yearns for what it does not have. Through her tender and perceptive reach into the inner lives of her characters, Alice Walker has expanded our notions of freedom and human experience. Like James Baldwin, Walker too has explored issues of homosexuality within the African-American community, of interracial relationships, of global issues, and also conflicts between black men and women. So this film, Beauty and Truth, looks at key moments in the life of an artist who's a self-confessed renegade and an outlaw, not shy of controversy. She has been praised and pilloried and is a fearless pioneer whose voice has driven people to express a whole gamut of human emotions, from joy, celebration, enlightenment, to anger and ruthless vilification. The film explores the compelling drama of her public and private life and hopes to offer fascinating insights into a complex emotional landscape. And what I have learned over the last few years in making this film, even though I knew her, I hadn't realized to what extent, how far back her rebelliousness, as it were, went from a very, very young age when she was growing up in the segregated South. And many of her personal and political choices have put her in the firing line. And as with all pioneers who have challenged history and envisioned new ways of seeing and living, her life has not been easy. From her birth in a family of sharecroppers in Georgia, her activism in the 1960s civil rights movement, to her pioneering writings, which have celebrated and given international visibility to black women's lives, Walker's historical and cultural resonance is undisputed. The historian, the late Howard Zinn, who wrote the incomparable People's History of America, and who was Alice Walker's first professor at Spelman College in Atlanta, said in an interview with me for this film, "The black presence that Alice has written about has brought African Americans into the vision of the country and the world, brought them in without stereotypes, without romanticizing them. In other words, brought African Americans into the sensibility of Americans as full, complex human beings. And this is an enormous contribution to understanding between whites and blacks." So I really just want to offer you a few reflections on a woman whose profound contribution to history, I think, has yet to be fully recognized and acknowledged. And I also want to share some clips from this work in progress. And some of you are the first people to see this. So, my personal trajectory as a filmmaker has been one of a passionate commitment to making films that explore experiences and stories rarely seen in mainstream media. Toni Morrison once said, "She writes the books she would like to read." And similarly, I make the films I would like to see. In my 20 or so years of making films, my first impulse always has been to capture and document so-called marginal subjectivities. I have found that it's often in the margins that the most exciting and stimulating textures of life get revealed. A lot happens at the periphery. In a crisis-ridden world that continues to recreate itself through the lens of a very small group of pale, heterosexist males, and it is a small group, my interest is in showing how a woman like Alice Walker continues to shift the dominant paradigm with her writings and activism. So what does it mean to make a film about an icon whose lifelong quest for authenticity and whose commitment to speak out about difficult taboo subjects has thrown her in the firing line of controversy time and time again? And how can I, as a filmmaker, do justice to the unique life and art of a writer whose journey has taken her a long way from her birth in a paper-thin shack on a cotton plantation in the Deep South to writing over 30 books of fiction, poems, and essays? It's been a challenge as a filmmaker to find active visual storytelling tropes when the character's medium is the word. I've looked, and the way the film has been shaped is to find ways of weaving together her poetry, her prose, interviews, and archival material to unfold a story not only of an individual, but also of the socio-political changes that were happening in the 50s, 60s, 70s, all the kind of decades that she grew up in and through. Alice's story is deeply entwined with the story of the civil rights movement and the movements for justice and equality for black people. She is shaped both by that history, but in turn, with her writings and her activism, has shaped and influenced that history too. And it's this dynamic that we capture in our film, hopefully to some good effect. James Baldwin always said that he thought of himself predominantly as a writer. And that is something that black women had not claimed, and certainly not on a national scene in the United States. Not until the 1970s and the 80s, when there was a literary renaissance of African-American women writers. And Walker was a key writer at that time, alongside Toni Morrison, Gloria Naylor, Maya Angelou, Toni Kade Bambara, amongst many others, whose literary outpourings contributed to the growing discipline of black women's literary theory. and Walker's contribution to shaping this intellectual and literary movement was enormous. Part of Walker's and her generation's genius is in allowing African-American women to claim their identities as writers and offer this identity as a concrete possibility for future generations. Before I show you the first clip, I have to admit that this is a really rare thing for me to do, which is to share a work in progress. So please excuse the kind of slightly rough nature of it. We haven't mastered the soundtrack yet, or the color, or the grade, and we are still editing. We still have another month of editing. I trust we won't be harsh judges. Thank you. Just to see when I found that archive footage of the shack that she grew up in, and with the wallpaper and the story about her mother and the brown paper bags, because I'd kind of known that she'd come from there, but then to actually see it, I think is very startling to me. And to then kind of have a kind of cognizance of what the arc of her life has been from there to where she is now. One of the things Alice Walker wrote was about the responsibility of what she felt her own responsibility was as a Southern Black writer. Southern Black writers, like most writers, have a heritage of love and hate, but that they also have enormous richness and beauty to draw from. We inherit a great responsibility as well, for we must give voice to centuries not only of silent bitterness and hate, but also of neighborly kindness and sustaining love. From her first novel, The Third Life of Grange Copeland, right through to The Color Purple, Walker invites her readers into the tangled and previously invisible web of Southern Black lives, spanning across generations from slavery and oppression to political revolution. By portraying her characters' lives at their most intimate and vulnerable, her work transcends cultural diversity and reveals the very core of what it means to be human. Walker's short stories, books, and poems have contributed significantly to the creation of an essential historical narrative of Southern Black people in America. While much of her writing has activist roots and is often imbued with a social conscience, there's always a poetic heart and a literary imagination at work. And I'm going to go straight into the next clip because I want to kind of you to experience a little bit of her literary imagination and then her story much further on in her life when she goes to Mississippi after hearing Dr. Martin Luther King urging people to go back home to the South rather than go up north and try and effect change in the South. So we could see that. Actually, her and Mel, who he was pretty much responsible, Melvin Leventhal, pretty much responsible as a lawyer, he was a civil rights lawyer, for desegregating education in the South alongside a number of other people. But he actually took on some of the test cases and pushed through desegregation in the South. And there, they had a daughter, Rebecca Walker, and going back a little step, it was actually illegal to be married as an interracial couple in Mississippi. They had anti-miscegenation laws. So they got married in New York, and then they came back to Mississippi to live as an interracial couple. They were the first legally married interracial couple living in Mississippi. And it was not safe for them. They would get the Ku Klux Klan putting things through their door. And Alice says in one of the interviews in the film further on that, you know, they had to have a gun. And she says, you know, even though she's a pacifist and is nonviolent by nature, she would have had to use it just to protect her child because it was pretty dangerous that people could come up to the porch of her house and they could have taken one more step and come inside. So, you know, she's pretty much broken taboos, not just through her writing, but through her personal life and the example of her life. I guess the book that she's most known for, that everyone, most people know and associate her name with, is The Color Purple. And this book was published in 1982, and it went on to win the Pulitzer Prize and went to the National Book Award and a whole number of other accolades. But as her biographer, Evelyn, says, actually, that people forget that The Color Purple was actually Walker's 10th book. And she really hadn't had that much exposure, even though this was her 10th book. And the book did well, but it wasn't until Steven Spielberg took the book on and made it into a Hollywood movie that it got exposed to a much, much broader and wider audience. And it also, the film, not so much the book, but the film, although it was Steven Spielberg's film, Alice Walker, for allowing Steven Spielberg to make the film out of her book, came under vehement attacks for the film and for the themes within the book and consequently in the film. And the criticisms really came from within her own community. She had dared to write about the taboo subjects of incest, rape, and domestic violence. And in a culture which had systematically oppressed black people, many felt that this exposure of dirty linen in the public arena was damaging to the black community. Walker's consistently received notoriety for her taboo-breaking and morally challenging depictions of African-American passions and oppressions. And in talking to Steven Spielberg, Quincy Jones, and Danny Glover, who are some of the key players in the making of the film Color Purple, I learned that all of them were actually, they were so sure when they were making the film that this is something so extraordinary and something so special that would be of service not just to the black community but as a kind of a gift and an offering that hadn't been done before, they were all pretty shocked and quite saddened by the negative press that the film received and the kind of attacks that Alice Walker came under. And so while The Color Purple gave Alice Walker the most accolades and international exposure in her life, I think it was also the source of the greatest trauma in her adult life. Before showing you the next clip, I wanted to share with you a couple of moments from the journey of making this film with Alice Walker. I had gone down with my small film crew to Eatonton, Georgia, which is Alice Walker's birthplace, to film some of the landscape where she grew up. And Alice happened to be doing something at Atlanta University at the time, so it was great. So she said, okay, I'll take you around my family's cemetery. So she walked me around the cemetery, and there's a small patch of land on which all her ancestors are buried. Nothing fancy, it's just wild grass and just some gravestones like you saw earlier on in the clip. And we walked around, and when we came to her mother's gravestone, she just laid this beautiful red shawl on it. And then we moved on, and she paused at the gravestones of her great-great-grandparents. And she turned to me and she said, you know, they were direct descendants of freed slaves. Oh, how they must rejoice in all of us being here today, so happy and so free, something that they could never have imagined. Another special kind of moment was to do, and again it was in Eatonton, Georgia, was to do with, when Alice Walker was 8, she was playing with two of her brothers, and they were playing cowboys and Indians, and one of her brothers accidentally shot her in the eye with a rubber bullet. And she started bleeding from that eye. And they lived way out, as you can see, they lived way out into the in the woods, away from the main road. So they rushed, her father and her brother rushed out to the main road. And as the father carried her in his arms with her eye bleeding, they tried to flag down a car so that they could go to the nearest doctor for treatment. And all these cars sped by, wouldn't stop. Finally, a car stopped. But then the white driver saw that she was bleeding, looked at them, and sped away. And if somebody had stopped and taken her to the nearest doctor or for medical attention, it would have saved the vision in her eye. But as it was, she was blinded in her right eye at the age of 8. And so while I was standing on this road, which is where nobody stopped for her, I was remembering also a story that she had told me that, ironically, many decades later, on that very same road, there were all these big banners saying, "Welcome home, Alice," and traffic jams of people going to the premiere of The Color Purple in the town. A theater, a little cinema theater, where young Alice and her friends could only go in by a separate colored-only entrance. So it's kind of to see that span of history within this one life. It was kind of quite an incredible moment for me as I kind of stood there. The next clip I want to show you is about The Color Purple, a section of it. The Color Purple was pretty much written out of her own experiences and the experiences of her family and people around her. And coming from there, I think there's no doubt that Walker, as a dedicated crusader for the physical, psychological, and spiritual survival of Southern Black women, and has declared her commitment to, quote, "exploring the oppressions, the insanities, the loyalties, and the triumphs of Black women." Consequently, the lives and experiences of Black women have permeated through all of her work, enshrining them in their complexity and fullness within the American literary canon. As a young girl, Walker witnessed the brutality and violence in the lives of Black women, many of whom she knew as a girl growing up in Georgia, some even in her own family. Walker has documented the stories of generations of Black women whose quality of life was devastated by perpetual sexual and racial oppression, as slaves, as sharecroppers, and as part of the vast population of the urban poor. Within her first 4 published works alone, Walker developed more than 25 complex female characters spanning several generations, from the slave woman to an empowered woman of the 60s. She critically examined both the social and political environments of these women and the complexities and turmoil of their inner worlds. One of the central themes within her work is the domination of powerless Black women by equally powerless Black men. This theme is particularly salient in one of her first novels, The Third Life of Grange Copeland, right through to The Color Purple, where Walker's female characters are raped, beaten, verbally abused, and humiliated by Black men. Soon after she published The Color Purple, she published a book of essays, which some of you may know of, called In Search of Our Mother's Gardens. And in this book, Walker defines and came up with the term womanism to describe the perspectives and experiences of women of color, lives that were all but silenced before her publications. She used this term to recast feminism so that it was reflective of the history and traditions of Black women. By digging deep into the inner landscape of her female ancestors, Walker has forged a cohesive matrilineal history for Black women. This literary validation of Southern Black women's harrowing journey to selfhood is a profound contribution to the women's movement and to feminism, one that cannot be underestimated. as a professor at Spelman University who I interviewed, who'd gone to school with her, said, it's hard to imagine what feminist theory or womanist theory would be like without Walker's essays and novels. And so for me, part of making this film is also a reflection of my interest in and a commitment to offering a specific feminist genealogy, one that sharpens contemporary concerns of transnational feminist concerns. Professor Henry Louis Gates, who many of you will probably be familiar with, he gave this quote, and he said, Walker contributed enormously to the construction of the idea of a black woman's tradition out of which she and a host of others could write, could ground and revise their fiction. It would be difficult to overestimate the signal importance of this foundational gesture. And far from being dated, Walker's critical writings, specifically her essay In Search of Our Mother's Gardens and her use of the term womanist, offers us a critical lens with which to rethink contemporary concerns around feminism and its relevance to women's lives. In The Color Purple, there's a character called Shug, one of the main female characters, who Alice defines as a womanist. And her definition of a womanist is, a black feminist or a feminist of color, usually referring to outrageous, audacious, courageous, or willful behavior, wanting to know more and in greater depth than is considered good for one, responsible, in charge, serious. I think that definition still counts, and I love to be say that I'm a womanist because I like outrageous, audacious, courageous, willful behavior from women. I think we need more of it, actually. One of the joys of being a documentary filmmaker is when you discover a piece of archive that you had not expected, you weren't looking for it, and it comes your way, and it makes your skin tingle. I spent some time researching Alice Walker's archives, which are now kept at Emory University in Atlanta. Before, though, I must say, before that her archive was sent off to Emory University, she allowed me to into her home in Northern California, and I was able to film in that last clip. You saw the handwritten journal, the spiral-bound journal, notebook rather, in which she wrote. That was where, that's the original manuscript of The Color Purple. So, and now it's out of bounds. It's in the archives and nobody can get to it. So I was able to film that. So I'm really kind of thrilled that I can share that with the world, to see her writing process, to see the scrawling handwriting, to see her things where she's kind of crossed things off and rewritten sentences. But while I was researching at Emory, I listened to it was completely not labeled correctly. It was labeled as something else, an interview with Alice on some radio program. So I was like listening to it, and it wasn't an interview on a radio program. It was a very rare and quite rough, technically, recording. Alice herself reading the essay In Search of Our Mother's Gardens. And it sounded to me like she was, and it was a recording done in 1973, so years before this was even published, because it was published a decade later. And it was a recording which sounded like she was in her, probably in her home, in her kitchen, practicing reading it to, you know, to an audience or at a conference or whatever. And, but despite the low quality of this recording, I kind of really wanted to put it into the film. So I've kind of created a little visual sequence. So this is the last clip. It's only 2 minutes long, and watch it. One of the wonderful things about finding this was also that I think you can really hear the difference in her voice, that the rawness of a kind of an emerging writer. But she also had a kind of a southern lilt to her voice, which over time she has lost. And all the sort of the black and white photographs in that sequence are of all women who were freed slaves, and who were, most of them were in their 90s and a couple were in their 100s. And I got them from the Library of Congress in D.C. And it was kind of really an attempt to give the image and a visualization to what Alice Walker is talking about when she's evoking the memory of all these women and what their lives would have been like. And what kind of spiritual life or what kind of dream life did they have too? What ambitions did they have that they could not fulfill because either they were enslaved or that they, you know, were unable to because they were having to breed children so that they could be sold off. I hope that with some of this clips and some of my talk that you would agree why I feel that Alice Walker's unique personal life should be preserved, should be documented, and should be available to a very broad audience. Because her unique personal story, I think, is also a lesson in truth-telling and its consequences on her life and on broader cultural and political moments in American history, as much as the international ramifications of her approach and sensibility. So I'm hoping that when our film is finished and out in the world, that it is an inspiring answer to at least one question. What does it take to forge a powerful, authentic, and a compassionate self in the crucible of poverty, hypocrisy, and cruelty, and make history in the process? Thank you.
Thank you so much for presenting this to us and showing us sort of a first look of your work process. It's been really a privilege. I have to say, as an African American just moving here to England, it's really interesting to see the African American story portrayed in a completely different setting, even if that setting is, you know, different in the sense of only geography. So I'm wondering what aspect of the Black woman's story resonated with you to the point that you decided to make this film?
What aspect of the Black woman's story?
Of the story, or rather the history of African American women. Part of that, I guess through Alice Walker's life and her dramatic life, what part of where you resonates with you personally?
Quite a lot of things kind of with Alice's story has resonated with me. I mean, it partly goes back to when I first met her, because I met her in 1991 when I made a documentary, I was making a documentary for Channel 4 television on African American women in the civil rights movement. And I was at that time interviewing Angela Davis and a poet called June Jordan, and also Alice, and that's when I met Alice Walker. And I think that, and I made that documentary because as a child of immigrant parents growing up in the UK, I was 11 when my parents came here to this country as economic migrants. I was born in Kenya, so I kind of have a very international diasporic kind of experience. I had found the writings that came out of the US and the kind of the movement for self-determination from the Black communities and the African American communities a touchstone for as a way to understand partly what was happening with immigrant communities in this country. So those were the sort of the books and the kind of activist work that actually showed me and gave me a language to understand my own kind of situation as a immigrant child growing up in this country. So I'd always had that kind of connection. And so when I'd met Alice Walker, I sort of, you know, and then it became a very personal friendship between us. And I think that's primarily where the film has come out of. But I guess my affinity is also in terms of my own work and as a filmmaker, is to make work that has a level of authenticity and that however difficult it is in the kind of, we were talking earlier about the within the broadcast industry, in the corporate media industries, to make work that has resonance and that has truth and that is not kind of tailored to certain kinds of marketing commercial potential and it's outside of those constraints, then I think that that's kind of partly what I've been inspired by Alice Walker in really staying true to her own voice, no matter what kind of fire has been thrown at her. And, you know, in the film, there's another sort of sequence where you really get to see the kind of attacks on Alice Walker when she wrote The Color Purple. You see it from archival footage of people on television programs damning her, saying The Color Purple is like the birth of the nation, and, you know, kind of just completely sort of annihilating her as a writer. So I think that, and then to see how she came through that. So for me, it's her story of a sort of inspiring for her courage, for her truth-telling, and willing to kind of really push the envelope. And, you know, I try and do that with my own work.
I think it's interesting that, and one can see this as somebody from a different generation, but it's interesting to me that the 60s are often decried, and yet the 60s was the period, really, of the civil rights movement. And it's often forgotten the impact it had on other struggles elsewhere. It opened other people's eyes up. For example, when I came as a lawyer to do cases in the late 70s and into the 80s, arising out of the Irish Troubles, what Irish activists always said was, we saw what was happening in America and the civil rights movement, and we started saying, well, why are we in the Catholic community of the North of Ireland, why are we second-class citizens? And so it created ripples of an enormous kind around the world, so that communities elsewhere drew sustenance. And of course, out of it developed the women's movement and all those other things. And so the ripples of those years in America had incredible consequence around the world, actually.
Mm.
Shall we wait for the
Thank you very much, first of all. It was wonderfully liberating, you know, for someone who spent all day on words locked into students' essays and textbooks, and to come here and to be able to move between word and image was an entirely joyous and liberating experience. Thank you very much for that. My question, you were just saying about the need to be, and you were true to her words, to her narratives. I would be interested to know a little bit more about how this film was conceived and made. To make a profile of someone so in control of her words, of her narratives, where was she in the making, in the conceptualizing of the film? The choosing selection of images, the way you drive forward the story, was that a partnership, a collaborative effort, or did she allow you to narrate your way?
Yeah, very interesting question. No, she, I actually, when I had the idea, I rang her up and I said, Alice, I'd like to do this film on you. And she said, okay, go for it. And then, you know, that was, here we are 4 years later. But she absolutely has had nothing to do. She's not even known what I'm doing most of the times. She, as at times, you know, when I wanted to interview Steven Spielberg or Quincy Jones, they would write to her because I would have got in touch with them, and they would write to her and they would say, is this filmmaker, should we be talking to this filmmaker? And then she would give her blessing and say, yes, of course, you know, she's making this film with my permission. The only thing she ever said to me was, Pratibha, I know you will be honorable. And that was it. That was the only thing she's ever said to me. And then, because we were having so many challenges getting funding for it, and she knew I was working on it, but she hadn't seen anything. I had interviewed her a couple of times, and then, you know, and she knew I was going to film other people, but she hadn't seen anything, and it was going on, and it was 2 years on, and it was like, you know. And I thought, okay, I better reassure Alice that there is a film happening. So I went to her home in Northern California, and I sat with her. With hindsight, I think, my God, why did I do that? But I mean, it was fine. I sat with her in her living room on the couch, and I showed her the first half hour of a rough cut, which was the first half hour was very much about, you know, some of which you saw, you only saw 7 minutes, but it was about her brothers, and her, there's only one brother who's alive now, the elder brother, but the guy who's driving around, Jimmy, he passed away. So, and I'd found this archive footage, and, you know, and so, and then there were stories about her mother and her father, and she just sat there and she watched it, and I sat next to her, and then she just said, she, you know, finished, and she said, it's beautiful, and then she was extremely tearful, and what she said was that it's such a reminder of that what brought us all through that was just love. She said, love is what brought us through all of that. We survived that through love as a family. And you know, that was very telling. And so then, you know, so that was it. And she didn't have anything else to say about it. Didn't have any kind of, you know, editorial or stylistic or anything. She just thought it was beautiful and, you know. And last weekend or the weekend before, I grabbed a sort of window in her schedule, went with the producer to New York, because she was in New York, and showed her the full rough cut, the 82 minutes film. And again, I sat in her hotel suite in the living room, and I played it on the DVD player. And it was just me and her. You know, she was laughing at places, she was saying, oh, and she was responsive, at the end she just sort of, you know, squeezed my hand and said thank you. So
what an affirmation of your
yeah
work.
it was you know, it was difficult because there are, I mean, I haven't shown you some of the clips, but there are difficult moments in and you know, I don't want the film, and I didn't set out, even though she's a good friend, I didn't set out to make a film that was a puff piece, you know. I didn't want to do that because I don't think it would do her any favors. And you know, there are things in her life that have been very difficult. She's publicly estranged from her daughter, and you know, in the U.S., that's kind of very much in the public domain. And there's all, and I had seen personally as a friend, I had seen her go through real pain around it. But at the same time, there were issues that, you know. I wanted it to be neutral. I want audiences to make up their own mind. I didn't want to take sides against her daughter or for, you know, so I just kind of wanted to create the complexity of what it means to be, you know, she was a single mother for a long time as she was emerging as a writer. She was traveling all over the country. She had to leave her daughter with friends, with people. So for women of her generation, and who were single mothers, economically challenged, trying to be writers, trying to be something that they were not meant to be, she had to make certain kinds of sacrifices. The focus was the work, and then other relationships suffered as a result. You know, but that's something that I think is kind of very much part of the history of a lot of women of a particular generation. Although I don't think a lot has changed now, actually, as you know.
So you had your hand up earlier on. Do you want to come in?
You mentioned just briefly now something about the kind of economic history of Alice Walker's life, and the fact that she was, part of the reason she was traveling was that she had to make money, right? I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the significance of the economic history of her life, because it's very striking to see the images of the women who were being interviewed, who are very considerable women in considerable institutions with considerable resources at their disposal, as opposed to the images of their great-grandmothers. And is there a sense, it seems to me in Walker's work and Morrison's work, there is a sense that love is important, but money also matters. And I was wondering if you could talk at all about that in your experience of her.
What the questioner was asking about was the economic shifts that while you have characterized this being a story of love that gave survival, and that was what held this family together and so on, what the questioner is saying is that, of course, money makes a difference, and you get a sense that, you know, amongst the women who are testifying to her, the other writers, the mm-hmm. Gloria Steinems and so on, that these are women living now in comfortable circumstances. To what extent is it about a real economic shift that's changed people's lives? Mm-hmm.
I think that there is, I think that's a really interesting perception, because, you know, I hadn't actually kind of seen it that way in terms of, like, who are the women testifying, as it were.
Well, even the black voices of women in the academy, voices of publishers and so on, that there's a sense in which middle-class black America is now a confident source of empowerment.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
So that shift has taken place.
Yeah, it's quite astounding to see how that shift has taken place within her lifetime. So, you know, she is now a very comfortable middle-class black American who, you know, because of her books and publications, is able to kind of live very comfortably through her art and through her creativity. But I think that it's very interesting, because it reminds me of when she was first sort of started, she was published and she went to New York, to live in New York after she went from Spelman College in Atlanta, then went to Sarah Lawrence, and then lived in New York. And when she was living in New York and starting to publish things, other black writers who were around in the 60s, particularly male writers and publications, were not interested in Alice Walker, because they were saying, oh, she's writing about country folk. Because there was this kind of real push and aspiration for middle class aspiration for economic security. So for her to be at a time when there was this kind of historical moment where in the 60s when people were like, really, like, we need to move away from the poverty, we need to move away from that, and we need to kind of have access to all these other resources as black communities in the US, she was sort of actually going against the grain on some level with her creative writing, because she was saying, no, hang on a minute, but what about the people in the rural areas? Because they are the forgotten poor. Because the urban poor were very much visible, but the rural poor were very much invisible. So I think she was out of favor even at that point. But I think what's interesting, what your question raises, I think what's interesting is to see how within her own lifetime we have seen whether we now have, you know, a black president, and hopefully he'll come back for a second term. So I declare myself as a Democrat.
Yes, please unmute.
Thanks, Freddie. It was such a great talk. Thank you so much, and wonderful to see the preview, sneak preview. I just wanted to follow on, really, I mean, to say a couple of points. One was how fascinating and important was your revelation just then about her relationship with her daughter and the pressures behind that, you know, which were financial, traveling, single motherhood, and so on and so forth. And it just reminded me, you know, of a very old political theme, but amazingly unaddressed, which is still the plight of working women and the damage actually that we've all encountered in our relationship with our children because of the continuing lack of support structures and so on, or the changing lacks of support structures. But yeah. It just reminded me of how, very sad to hear, but how important that theme is, and I hope that comes out somehow in the film in some sensitive way. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that fascinated me, which you've been telling us about, was the way that, you know, here's this huge context of her being very active in civil rights. And then, as you've impressed on us, she takes the decision to write in the language of poor black women and about essentially those women's experience, well, you know, enlivened for fictional purposes. But that, the bravery, but the courage and the political point of that move, which is to make a feminist statement within the era of black civil rights, when other issues are to the fore, is so extraordinary, and that's such a dimension of what her impact has been. And I say that because you and I were briefly chatting earlier, but you know, if you take the period of British black filmmaking in the 70s and 80s, once again, I just saw the link. I mean, what you get are young British black filmmakers, women filmmakers, who decide to open up the questions of feminist politics within British filmmaking, black British filmmaking. Okay. And I've just seen that they're inheriting, actually, this stance from Alice Walker, which I'd never seen before. Mm-hmm. So I was again very grateful for the way that you showed her tenacity and her sort of her contrariness in insisting on that political position in an era when other politics were much more to the fore somehow. Yes, and yes. How significant that was, you know.
Yes, yeah. No, I think it's, well, a number of things in that, to that, really. One of the things about her sort of embrace of the language, the rural black language, and to write The Color Purple in that language. Part of it is, she talks about in a sequence in the film about the inspiration of her, what she sees as her mentor, Zora Neale Hurston. Now, Zora Neale Hurston was an African-American woman writer during the Harlem Renaissance, and she wrote a number of amazing books. One of them was Their Eyes Were Watching God, which is, again, written in the language of Southern black people. And she was an anthropologist, and she traveled around the South collecting songs and collecting music and filming people and writing in that, the language that she came across. She died. She had a white patron who took care of her and then abandoned her. Zora Neale Hurston died completely kind of penniless. Nobody knew about her, really. Her books went out of print. And Alice, as a young writer, looking for sort of some mentors in her line of work, as she says, to see what had come before her, found and read a biography on Zora Neale Hurston, and took it upon herself to go to down to Florida, where there was this cemetery with Zora's unmarked grave, but it was everything was grown over it. She couldn't, and she went searching for it, finally found it, and with sort of put together a bit of money as a struggling writer. She didn't have much money, but like put together $60-$70, and you know, I have filmed the receipt of that. And she got a gravestone for Zora Neale Hurston and called her the genius of the South, and just said this is who she was, and then was responsible for publishing, getting Zora's books published and reprinted, and bring her, and so there became then a Zora Renaissance. So I think the part of that kind of, I suppose, it's almost as if it was a love letter to Zora to write The Color Purple, in that there's kind of real similarities between that and Zora's work. So that's one thing. There was something else I wanted to answer to.
The business of going against the grain of yes. the political tide.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, she's still doing it. She's, you know, she went on the flotilla to Gaza 2 years ago. I mean, she's very much an activist, and you know, she went to Gaza and she met people, and she says, you know, this is what we were experiencing. It's worse than what we were experiencing in the South during segregation, and you know, so she uses her sort of celebrity profile. Talk about things that are really still, I mean, particularly within the US, to talk about Palestinian rights is a kind of a big no-no. I mean, I've already been told, I had a meeting with somebody in New York, and I was told, you know, expect your film not to be selected by certain film festivals in the US because, you know, because it's Alice Walker and you have her in the film, kind of with footage of her on the Gaza flotilla. But the film is 82 minutes long, and this little sequence is kind of 1 minute 20 seconds. Yet it, you know, so I think that it's kind of in her DNA, is to just always kind of, she seems to always, in following her own truth, it seems always to be against the kind of prevailing status quo or what people expect of her. And I think that her, I mean, I've talked to a number of sort of younger African-American women in the US, and they, you know, have sort of, they say without her work or work of Toni Morrison or some of the other women writers, they say we would never have even ever considered becoming writers or even thinking about the lives of these black women that these writers have actually portrayed. So I think that that's kind of open, their work and Walker's work has kind of opened up this whole other universe in a way, which is not just confined to particular communities, but that it's kind of impacted so broadly. And, you know, talking about sort of young black filmmakers from the 80s here in the UK, it was not just filmmakers, because I think that there's, I worked in a feminist publishers for a while, and we published African-American women's writings here, which they weren't available before we published them here. So there was always this kind of very transatlantic relationship between what was happening there and how we all were influenced as young people of color, black people, Asian people, who were looking for ways to kind of articulate our own situation, to create our own kind of cultural forms that came, that were specific to our journeys and our experiences. And I think, you know, for me, I know Alice Walker's work. I mean, I'd read In Search of Our Mother's Gardens when I was at university, or when I was really young, and I thought it had a profound effect on me. I mean, when I read it, I never ever imagined that I would one day meet her and even make a film about her. But, you know, those writings were kind of profoundly influential for many of us, I think, here.
Well, Fatima, I think that we have exhausted you and made great demands on you. Has anybody else got another question there?
Shall I go?
I've
got a question.
I'll make this the last one, okay?
It might be a bit broad and quite... Okay, there might not be enough time to kind of talk about it, but I was really struck when I was watching the film about the idea of kind of empowered black women and kind of reclaiming or like being confident with the way they present themselves, so like having an afro and being really strong to kind of use their own dialect as well. And I've seen your other film with June Jordan and Angela Davis in the same...
I'm so sorry, but the echo in this room is making it really difficult for me to hear. Come forward.
Okay. did you hear any of it? Or
I but start again. Sorry.
Okay. I was wondering about the idea of.
Yeah.
I was wondering about the idea of empowered women, and in your film, she's very confident with kind of being a black woman and using black American dialect. And I saw your film with Angela Davis and June Jordan as well, and it's the same kind of principle of being very strong and very, very confident. And I was wondering, in terms of modern black feminism today, do you think the same things apply? Or because to me it seems it's very westernized almost, or feminism in general is almost being commodified and kind of presented in quite a distorted way, perhaps, or like that, I don't know, the idea that a very sexualized idea of feminism can exist now. And I was wondering, do you think,
I think that's an interesting question.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You've been presenting images of confident black women arguing their case for why there needs to be a world that has a different sort of negotiation. Mm-hmm. And And yet, contemporary feminism is often a distortion of feminism, and it is often about women being sexualized and commodified, and in fact, the question was really to say, how do you perceive contemporary feminism, particularly contemporary black feminism? Do you think it is as confident? Do you think it is as self-assertive? Do you think it is as self-assured? Or do you think it's become confused with commercialization?
I think it's hard to kind of make a generalization about it, but I definitely have met and seen and a whole sort of, not even the second wave, but like a third wave feminists who are from all different communities. So, you know, women of color, black women, white women, young women, who are confident feminists. And I think there's so much hopefulness around it and out there. And in the US, there's kind of lots and lots of local organizing that goes on amongst black women and black feminists. I think that the problem is that, you know, in the first wave feminism, there was a kind of a very clear ways in which women organized and around very clear kind of demands about equal pay, about breaking through the glass ceiling, you know, childcare, all these kind of concerns. And I think now the demands are much more amorphous, and that because of commercialization and because of a kind of a complete, that feminism became this dirty word, you know, a word that people were embarrassed, a lot of women are embarrassed to say that they're feminist. It became sort of the F word became unutterable. And I actually think, I don't know what you think, Elena, but I actually think that there is now a whole new wave. I mean, I go and speak in schools and things, and I meet young women who, you know, are as fierce feminists as some of the women in the film. And, you know, they're out there, and they're part of the Occupy movement, or they're part of, you know, the movement around the environment, not just specifically around women's rights. But, you know, those women are out there and doing their thing. So, yeah, I think that, you know, there are empowered black women and other women out there.
I'm going to let you have a rest.
Thank you.
Before
Okay.
Can I just say to everybody, I'm sure that you share with me in saying that this was a really terrific event tonight. I want to thank you, Pratibha. I think you've inspired us. I think that lots of people are going to feel empowered and uplifted by the film and by your account of making this film. I just loved, I thought it was delicious hearing about how you did it, how you've made it work, and then seeing just how brilliantly creative you are and being reminded of that was wonderful tonight. Anyway, I hope you'll join with me in thanking Pratibha for coming here tonight and letting you see just what a remarkable woman she really is. Amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, but you can't not really with her.
It's so poetic and beautiful.